everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. Hey, how are you doing today on this beautiful May 20th, 2014? Well, it's beautiful, finally, here in New York City. And one of the things that I love to do, you know, I love food. It's all about food. And I really enjoy eating outdoors. And we have a little terrace. And I got to eat outdoors several times today already, so it's a good day. Feeling the sun on me, making a little vitamin D while I'm eating. That's the way it's supposed to be, right? And this past weekend, you may know I live in the county of Queens in New York City, and we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the World's Fair back in 1964-1965 this weekend at the Queens Flushing Meadows Corona Park. Does anybody remember the World's Fair back in 1964-1965? Raise your hand. Who remembers? I remember. I was just a little thing then, but it made some tremendous impressions on me. And just going back and visiting this past weekend made me think of all the incredible things that have happened over 50 years. And can you imagine what is going to happen in the next 50 or at least the next 10 or 20? I cannot even imagine, but I know it's going to be good. Something to look forward to. Now, let's get back to food. My favorite subject. We're going to be talking about some serious food conversations here, serious food topics, and I'm going to bring on my first guest. Lauren Ornelas is the founder, director of Food Empowerment Project, a vegan food justice nonprofit seeking to create a more just world by helping consumers recognize the power of their food choices. Food Empowerment Project works in solidarity with farm workers, advocates for chocolate not sourced from the worst forms of child labor, and focuses on access to healthy foods in communities of color and low-income communities. When Lauren was the director of Viva USA, she investigated factory farms and ran consumer campaigns. In cooperation with activists across the country, she persuaded Trader Joe's to stop selling all duck meat and was the spark that got the founder of Whole Foods Market to become a vegan. She served as campaign director with the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition for 6 years, and we can learn more about her at her websites, foodispower.org and veganmexicanfood.com. Lauren, welcome to It's All About Food.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Yes. Well, you are quite the powerhouse. And I've been following you for a long time, and I'm very glad I'm having the opportunity to have a little chat here with you.
It's wonderful to speak with you.
Yeah. So I hope we can hear you good enough. The connection is could be a little clearer. So just speak up, and we want to hear everything that you say.
Okay, great.
Okay. Now, Food Empowerment Project. If you go to foodispower.org, we can see all the different issues that you're working on. The thing that I want to talk about to start with is the issue of human slavery. Can we talk about that? You know, when I'm a vegan, I've been a vegan for a long time. And one of the responses that I used to get, not so much anymore, is that people say, you care so much about the animals, what about people? And many of us try to connect the dots because it is all connected. But we treat animals poorly, we treat humans terribly, and we treat children terribly. So what's going on with food production and human slavery?
Sure. I'll basically talk about two different types. And first of all, thank you for recognizing that these connections absolutely do exist. And that was one of the reasons why I started Food Empowerment Project, with our focus being food, because many of us vegans, you know, we started down this path because we are very compassionate people. We have a sense of what is and is not just, and we don't want to participate in those types of industries that cause harm to others. And with our food choices, it's an easier way to have an impact here. So when it comes to slavery, what got me thinking about this issue when it comes to chocolate was a English documentary where they actually interviewed a former slave for the chocolate industry. And the interviewer asked him, what would you say to people who eat chocolate? And his response was, they're eating my flesh.
Oh.
And as a vegan, I thought, well, that's the same thing as a non-human animal would say. And I had to really start to evaluate all of my food choices. And what's happening with the chocolate industry is in West Africa, there's approximately 1.8 million children who are victims of the worst forms of child labor, which also can include slavery. Here you have, basically Western chocolate companies not paying farmers what they should be paid for the amount of work and the product that they're producing. So they in turn end up employing children, and some end up basically sometimes stealing children from marketplaces and having them work for the chocolate industry, for the cocoa industry, where they go and they actually use dangerous equipment such as machetes to cut the cacao pods out of the cacao trees. Huh. Some children as young as 7 years old.
Now, I first found out about this maybe over a decade ago. And I'm sure it's been going on for a long time. Has there been any improvement?
There's been more awareness. I mean, I say awareness knowing that most people honestly still don't know about this issue. There has been legislation passed in the United States, the Harkin-Engel Protocol, to work on this issue. But in terms of real concrete changes, there haven't been a lot. There are more certifications out there. Food Empowerment Project does not suggest people go based on certifications if they want to buy chocolate that doesn't come from West Africa. We encourage people to base their chocolate choices on the country of origin, which is why we created our chocolate list that lists companies we do and do not recommend based on where the chocolate is actually sourced from, which also has two apps that people can download for free. But the problem, unfortunately, is just incredibly prevalent, and we haven't seen it lightening up at all.
Okay, so where is chocolate grown where we can be confident that they're treating people properly?
So outside of West Africa, although we do have one company on our recommended list, which grows cacao in Ghana, and there are worker-owned cooperatives. So the workers actually have the say, and it's not under the guise of Western corporations making these decisions. But elsewhere around the world is Latin America. You have Mexico. You have Indonesia and just other places. And actually Hawaii is trying to get it off the ground as well. But cacao isn't grown just anywhere.
Okay, now you have this great list on your website, foodispower.org/chocolate-list. And it's a long list of different companies that sell chocolate. And there's the good and there's the not so good. And then there's – can you talk a little bit about this list and how it was created?
Sure.
How you got this information?
Absolutely. So when I would give talks about the chocolate issue, people would inevitably say, well, what chocolate can I eat? And so we realized we had to create a resource for people. And since we're a vegan organization, any company on that list has to make at least one vegan chocolate bar. So we'll get emails from people asking about Häagen-Dazs or other companies, and we'll explain that, you know, unless they make a vegan product, they don't make our list. So that's the first criteria, obviously, because of the suffering of cows in the dairy industry.
Mm-hmm.
But second to that is that we recommend companies that are not sourcing from West Africa. So those are the companies that are recommended. We don't recommend companies that will not be transparent, meaning that when we've asked them, where are you sourcing your cacao from, they refuse to tell us. And surprisingly on that list is Clif Bar, which is why we have a campaign right now to get Clif Bar to disclose. We also can't recommend companies that don't respond to us either. So that's kind of the breakdown of our list. We do give, you know, we contact the companies and we give them about a month and a half to 2 months to respond to us with three contacts. So we contact them at least three times.
Now, I'm going through this list and I've been here before. I have mixed feelings when I visit here because my heart always sinks when I read the long list of the ones that you don't recommend. It's just, oh, no. But, you know, if not eating chocolate is our worst problem, we're not doing too badly.
Right, exactly. Well, the good thing is that enough people have written some of their favorite companies on our do not recommend list based on if they didn't respond or because they're sourcing. And we have had companies change suppliers, and we've also had companies be transparent with us. And honestly, transparency is the first step in creating any change out there.
So I just wanted to point out a few 365 Dark Chocolate Bar by Whole Foods. You feel comfortable recommending. There's a lot of other on this list, but then the ones that I guess are the most well-known in my world, I just wanted to bring up. So the ones that you cannot recommend just flat out, that's a pretty short list. Hershey's, Scharfenberger,
yeah.
And this other one, Nori Sirius Chocolate. So that you flat out know where they're sourcing the chocolate and they're bad.
Yes.
And have they responded?
We didn't even bother contacting Hershey because we know very well where they source from. And actually, you know what? We did end up contacting them because at first we didn't have them on our list because we didn't think they made anything vegan. And then we found out they made cocoa powder. So that's really the only ingredient that we product we know that they make that's vegan. But, yeah, so if you look down, the companies who we just don't recommend at all means they didn't even – make any noises like we're aware of the issue and we're trying, you know.
Say that again. The ones that didn't. Can you repeat that? I just missed that. You said the companies that weren't making any noises about what?
Yeah. So basically, when our list, when we have that the companies are not recommended but working on it, that means that we're not going to recommend them because they're still sourcing from West Africa, but that they at least said were aware of the issue and maybe they have some type of certification. But a film called Shady Chocolate, which came out maybe a year or so ago, exposed a lot of the certifications and that they were still finding child labor, possibly trafficked children on many of these farms that were certified.
Wow. And then there are the companies that just don't respond at all. And I know Trader Joe's is really good at not responding to a lot of questions about where they source food or where their food is made. I have some close relatives that are always concerned about celiac and whether food is contaminated with wheat or gluten, and they're not very transparent about that information. So I'm not surprised that they're not transparent about chocolate either.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's the deal with Clif Bar? I thought they were a nice company.
Well, they definitely, you know, do some things in the social responsibility realm that they should be credited for, but the lack of transparency when it comes to chocolate is a big black mark on their record.
Mm-hmm.
And it is something that we have a right to know as consumers, especially when we're talking about something as serious as child labor and possibly slavery. So we want consumers to reach out to them and ask them to be accountable for where their chocolate's coming from. And again, all we're asking for is transparency. We're not asking for the city or even the state or the name of the farm. All we're asking for is country of origin. So to claim that this information is proprietary is an absolute joke.
All right. It's easy to point the finger at other countries and say, yeah, they treat their people horribly here, but unfortunately, we don't have a very good record here in the United States either. So I was just reading today or a few days ago in the New York Times talking about children on tobacco farms in this country and how the laws are written so that families get away with this.
Yeah, it's really appalling. I'm glad that report came out recently, and there's been a lot of noises as well about farm workers in the produce industry, where we as vegans should also be concerned about where our food is coming from and how those workers are treated. And here in the United States, you have approximately 400,000 children who work, you know, here in the fields. You have some children as young as 5 years old who are working, and these are all because of loopholes in the federal law. It's because the fact that these farmers are unwilling to pay the farm workers living decent wages, even though these people work countless hours a day, sometimes 14 hours a day in extreme temperatures, providing food for all of us. I mean, unless you're eating only what you grow out of your garden, more than likely your food is coming from farm workers who are not treated right in this country. And it's absolutely appalling that this country allows this to continue.
Now, I remember reading maybe 5 years ago or so about the tomato industry in Florida, and there was a movement there to expose the slavery. It was outright slavery of people
yes.
being brought in from other countries, Mexico and other places, to Florida against their will, even thinking that they were going to be getting an opportunity, and then they were the stories were horrific. And there has
yes.
been some progress, and basically, the companies are charging like a penny more a pound or something ridiculous in order to treat these people better and guarantee better conditions for them.
Exactly. What they do in the United States, what these contractors do at times, is they take the passports away from the workers. So they're kind of, they don't have anywhere to go. Their freedom is taken away. And it's the coalition of Immokalee workers who are working on this in Florida, and all they're asking for is exactly one penny more per pound for the bushel of tomatoes that they pick. And they've been successful in getting a lot of corporations to do this, yet they still currently have campaigns against Wendy's and Publix who have yet to just agree to pay one penny more per pound for the tomatoes they pick.
Yeah, it's just crazy. So where else do we have slavery in the United States?
There is, not surprisingly, the animal agriculture industry also has, slavery riddled through some of their supply chains, where you have workers maybe coming from Peru and other countries, where they come to work in, say, cattle ranching, and they'll have these workers basically in the middle of nowhere, where the farms will actually go and provide the workers with water and with food, and they're left to the elements themselves. They don't have cell phone access. Huh. If they run out of water, they're kind of at the mercy until the ranchers come back to bring them water. So it's, you know, unfortunately, these situations, exactly as you said, we can't just point to another country. We need to look here and see what it is that we're doing in our own country.
Okay, so what do we do? Clearly, when it comes to animal agribusiness, we don't eat animals. But for all of us compassionate vegans who need our fruits and vegetables, how do we know that the people that are providing our food are treated well?
Exactly. No, I know. And I so appreciate all the compassionate vegans who want to go beyond veganism in their compassion. And with farm workers, it's a difficult task. It's not like we can look for a certain seal. It's not like we can look at where it's sourced from. What we can do, you know, our organization tries to do things. We did a school supply drive last year for the children of farm workers. We're going to be doing a food supply drive, ironically, for farm workers in the next couple weeks to help them have food on their tables. Buying organic, you know, kind of like if you know how cows are treated in the dairy industry, you know, organic doesn't necessarily mean the cows are treated any better. It's the same way with the farm workers, but it does mean one less bad thing is happening to them. So if you can afford to buy organic, that is a good thing. Speaking out to the grocery stores, letting them know it matters to you. If you go to the farmer's market, make sure that you talk to the people who are there about, you know, how the workers are treated and make sure that they know it's important to you. There are a couple of seals and certifications that are being worked on, but most seem in the preliminary stages at this point. But it isn't as easy as go vegan or the chocolate issue when it comes to our produce at this point.
Oh, wow.
I know. I know, right? It's just
yeah.
so...
Yeah.
But the thing is the more, you know, you can lend your voices to state legislation and any regulations. We try to keep people informed on regulations and legislation so that people know when they can use your voices. I mean, think about some of the changes. We have a long way to go for animals, but some of the changes that our collective voices have made for non-human animals, we can use our voices collectively as well to take care of the human animals, too.
I guess at least we're talking about it, and that's a first step. There's so many things that go on in this world, in the United States, horrible things. There's child abuse and all kinds of molestation and abuse is going on that we don't see, we don't know about, battering, and the list is endless, and there's more legislation that's trying to prevent all of these things, but so much of it is just out of our view. It's really hard to know what's going on.
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm just going to put a little light out there, put a little energy out there, and hope for the best. Okay, let's move on then. So what else is going on with the Food Empowerment Project?
So a couple of things. One is we have a newsletter for new vegans or people who are interested in going vegan. And it's a newsletter that they will receive in the mail for free if they sign up, and they get one issue a month for the year. And our hope is that to kind of be a way of support for new vegans, so that they have a reminder every month as to why they made this decision. So every issue comes with a story of an animal and how they're treated in the ag industry, as well as a rescue story from various sanctuaries, including Vine and Farm Sanctuary and some of the other sanctuaries around the country, happy stories of these animals when they get into sanctuaries. It also includes recipes, nutrition information, and also information on environmental and labor issues, so that if somebody is going vegan for, you know, everybody goes vegan for different reasons, but if it's for an environmental reason, they can also be reminded of all the reasons why it helps the animals as well as the planet to not consume animals any longer. So that's something we just launched in January, and we're taking 500 sign-ups for that. And one of the other projects we have going on is our Access to Healthy Food work, which we're currently working in Vallejo. Again, if people aren't familiar, lack of access to healthy foods is a big problem in communities of color and low-income communities, which is often referred to as a food desert. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to make an assessment of the foods that are and aren't available, not only fruits and vegetables, but also meat and dairy alternatives. Many people of color were lactose intolerant, so we need to have those dairy alternatives, as well as those young people who want to go vegan, who want to have some of the alternatives available. So we're trying to see what is and isn't available in these communities and help the groups that work on these issues gain better access.
Great. Now you have now on to a happy subject, and you
because thank you.
Well, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, sometimes I just throw up my hands and I go, just go vegan. It'll just solve so many things. It doesn't necessarily solve the people that are the conditions of the people growing the vegetables, but it does solve many, many problems, and from there we can solve the rest of them. But the point is that the food is delicious, and you have another website, Vegan Mexican Food. Is that it?
Yes, veganmexicanfood.com.
.com.
It's fully translated in English and in Spanish.
Right. Now, what motivated that?
I'm a Chicana, so I'm, you know, used to growing up with Mexican food, and a lot of our food is pretty easy to be made vegan. Some is already vegan. And so it made sense to me to reach out to our communities and make sure that we were aware of the different types of foods that are available. We take recipes from anybody who wants to donate their recipes. We're trying to keep it pretty grassroots, that we want people who support our work to donate and get credit for the recipes. But some of the recipes come from my family, who over the decades now have had to figure out different foods to veganize so that I could eat with everyone.
What to feed Lauren? She's such a problem.
That is a big problem in general, definitely.
Well, I love Mexican food, beans and beans and beans and rice and rice and rice. I can eat it all day and just throw a bunch of spices on them, and it's great, and it's cheap.
It is, yes.
Oh, now you've gotten around. So you were in your bio it said you were the spark that got the founder of Whole Foods to go vegan. How did that happen?
I was running a group called Viva USA at the time, where I conducted investigations of factory farms and slaughterhouses, and we did investigations across the U.S. of duck farms, and part of our campaign was making sure that the grocery stores quit selling duck meat. As you mentioned, we were successful in getting Trader Joe's to stop selling duck meat, as well as a couple of small natural health food stores and Pier 1 Imports to stop using feathers in all of their products. Mm. But Whole Foods was a difficult target. I believed, I'm from Texas, they're based in Texas, I thought it would be all Texas friendly, they would just listen to me, but didn't turn out that way, and so we got them to quit carrying duck meat from one of the farms we investigated, and were not as quickly successful in getting the other farm. So we actually had a campaign against Whole Foods Market for a number of years, which took place across the country, and the founder of Whole Foods and I had a, I don't know, a nice way to call it. We met, let's say, at a shareholders meeting, and I spoke, and we spoke afterwards, and he and I emailed back and forth for several weeks after that meeting, kind of going back and forth, arguing about everything. And finally he said, you know, I'm done talking to you. I don't have anything more to say to you. So I just wrote him back one more email, because that's just how I do it. And then 6 months later, about, he wrote me and said that after our conversation, he'd done a lot of reading and read up on the issue, and that he had made a decision to go vegan.
Wow. And how did you feel about that? That was huge. I remember reading about that.
Yeah. I fell out of my chair. I keep getting, it's absolute truth. I just couldn't believe it. It was like one of the rolly chairs. And, you know, being a nonprofit, it wasn't the most stable, brand new chair or anything. So that's probably aided to why I fell out of my chair. But, yeah, I literally fell out of my chair and just kind of was waiting to see, like, how real was this, you know, because it could have been a hoax. He could have just thought that way for a little while. And, yeah, it was quite amazing. And we've been in touch still over the years, and we communicate. In the beginning, we communicated a lot, and I'd give him my input, and I still do on a lot of what Whole Foods is up to. But, yeah, it was very shocking.
Well, that was a huge accomplishment, because Whole Foods isn't perfect. No person or company is perfect, but they have done a lot of very good things, and I think some of it stems from John Mackey's decision to go vegan and want to offer more whole, minimally processed foods that are affordable, so that people can get kale if they want it. And I think that was a very powerful thing. So thank you for that. You can you can just take the rest of your life off and relax. You don't have to do any more work. You've done.
Yeah. Well, I've heard that. I'm waiting for my heart and my head to feel that way. But at this point, it's still more pushing to be done. But thank you. It was pretty amazing.
Well, I look forward to hear what you do next and who you convince to go vegan next.
Well, thank you very much. And I thank you for, it's so hard doing this work and feeling like, you know, there's sometimes overwhelming, the issues that we work on at Food Empowerment Project, but it helps when people like you care and want to learn and want to make a difference. So, and thanks for ending this on a lighter note. So it's not so heavy for me feeling like I just depressed everybody.
I know, it is so hard. But here, I'm sending some light out to you too. Yeah.
Thank you.
What I like to do on this program, it's a safe place for vegans to talk about the good things and the not-so-good things. Thank you, Lauren, for joining me.
Great. Thanks so much.
Okay. Be strong.
Thanks. Take care.
Okay. Wow, that was Lauren Ornelas. And find out more at foodispower.org, because it is. Food is power. And I definitely recommend going to that list on their website about chocolate, because we don't want to be supporting child slavery. And they've made it easy to do that by avoiding the companies that we know are questionable or aren't being transparent. Shall we take a little break? Okay, and we're going to talk a little bit more about the injustice of our food system with Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs. everybody. I'm back. It's Karen Hartglass, and we're right in the middle of the program. It's all about food. It's always funny to hear those commercial breaks when you hear your own voice. It's like, wait a minute, that's me, but I'm here. No, I'm there. Yes, shall we talk some more about food, my favorite subject? Before, at the beginning of the program, I was talking about the World's Fair, and I want to talk a little bit more about that just before we move on to the next guest. And when I was a kid and I went to the World's Fair, it was a spectacular thing, and one of the things that I loved was the Ferris wheel. There was the U.S. Tires, which is now Uniroyal, had a big Ferris wheel, and there was this replica. It was a toy that you could buy, and I so wanted that little replica, that little Ferris wheel toy, and I didn't get it. And going back to visit the anniversary festival this weekend, they had at the Queen's Museum all kinds of things from the original fair, and they had that little replica Ferris wheel behind the glass along with a lot of other things, and I looked at it, and it was nothing. It was, I just kept thinking, I couldn't believe that I coveted this thing so intensely. Well, I was six at the time, but looking at it and seeing how nothing it is, it made me laugh. It made me think about so many things, the way we perceive things, either as children or adults, something having power or being so magical, when really it's just something we're creating in our heads. We have a lot of power in our heads, and we should be doing good things with them. Anyway, it was fun to see. So let's talk about food, shall we? And I'll bring on my next guest, Keith McHenry. He's an artist and author and helped start Food Not Bombs in Massachusetts in 1980. He has recovered, cooked, and shared vegan food with the hungry for over 30 years. Keith has been arrested nearly 100 times for his efforts, spending over 500 nights in jail, and at one point faced 25 to life in prison. He co-authored Food Not Bombs, How to Feed the Hungry and Build Community, and wrote and illustrated Hungry for Peace, How You Can Help End Poverty with End War with Food, Not Bombs. Keith, welcome to It's All About Food.
Yeah, thanks for having me. That's exciting.
Oh, you are so exciting. You have been doing such great work for so long. How do you do it?
Well, you just have to wake up every morning and go find some food and cook it. That's basically it. And there's no problem finding people that need food. And the biggest kind of crazy thing it has been that it's vegan food, and to watch this coming Saturday, the 24th of May, is the 34th anniversary of the founding of Food Not Bombs. And it's just, you know, at the beginning, people had no idea what vegan and vegetarian food was. And now, you know, people that really aren't even vegan are excited to come eat our food because they know it's organic, whole foods, and makes them feel a lot better. So even though they might be eating at Burger King and McDonald's some time during the week, we start hearing more and more from people that they really appreciate our food, even though it doesn't have meat.
Okay, now let's just talk about the title to begin with, Food Not Bombs. It's pretty self-explanatory, but I imagine, especially now with all of the with our phones being tapped and all kinds of undercover work, anything that has the word bombs in it is going to be looked at kind of questionably. Have you had problems with the name at all?
The name has caused some problems over the decades. And we discovered not long after we were first arrested for feeding the hungry in Golden Gate Park in August of 1988, that we had been declared one of America's most hardcore terrorist groups. And we learned that Thanksgiving weekend. It turned out that the National Guard armies all around the country had a workshop on domestic terrorism, which featured our logo. And we know that because National Guard's personnel returning home from the weekend would approach our volunteers or just people who happened to have purchased a Food Not Bombs button and had it on their coat. and said, oh, wow, we just studied them in domestic terrorism class. They're America's most hardcore terrorist group. And then most recently, in April of 2009, there was a on C-SPAN, I happened to catch this lecture twice, where a State Department official compared Food Not Bombs to Al-Qaeda, who was more dangerous, Al-Qaeda or Food Not Bombs, and their conclusion was that we were more dangerous because people liked us, we were friendly, people enjoyed the food, and it was a threat because Americans might think money should be diverted from military spending towards things like education, healthcare, and stuff like that.
Oh, I was wondering what they were worried about. I see now. So they think that you might take money away from the defense and put it towards healthier food and health care. What a concept.
Yes, and this is apparently, you know, I saw the lecture on C-SPAN when I was speaking at Princeton, you know, after my lecture at Princeton. Then I went to speak at Harvard Law a couple of days later, saw it again. If I had not seen it again, I would have thought I hallucinated the entire program. And, you know, it's apparently it's just that simple, that they are concerned that the American people will come across a Food Not Bombs table and see all the people coming to eat, and then want to, and then start talking to us, see the sign saying Food Not Bombs and so on. And then, lo and behold, we end up convincing them that they should, you know, organize with, you know, when a congressional candidate comes up for election or something and says, oh, yeah, I'm going to fund Social Security, or I'm going to fund housing, or I'm going to fund SNAP or WIC or something like that, that they will do it. And then, oh my goodness, there's another $1 billion gone from building drones or like this whole thing that Chuck Hagel's been talking about, $38 billion to upgrade nuclear weapons arsenal. And until the Ukrainian crisis, it didn't seem likely that we'd be at war with Russia again. So, you know, maybe that's part of the war on Russia theory, is we need to scare the American public into spending money on bombs.
Well, I think it may sound simple, but if we could make sure every person on this planet was well fed, we wouldn't see the majority of problems that we see on the planet today.
That's right. You would not be able to even recruit actual real terrorists to be terrorists if everybody had adequate nutrition or in the security, just knowing that you will be able to eat.
Yep.
And I was in Ethiopia a couple of years ago at the vegan, both the first and the second Ethiopian Vegan Association conference. And there's like 2 million people facing starvation right now. And the crazy thing is that there's just this amazing amount of food being grown in Ethiopia. The Nile River is irrigating massive areas of cropland, beautiful produce, amazing amount of tulips that are grown for the European market by Dutch companies. Mm. So there's all this food being exported out of Ethiopia while 2 million people are facing starvation. And this is very common with famines, where there's adequate food, the local food was actually diverted to people living there. It's all about lack of democracy and about profit.
Yes.
And now, for instance, Africa with mass starvation all across the continent, huge amounts of land are cultivated. There's, it's an amazingly great agricultural continent, but that food now is being controlled by like either European or Chinese or Saudi, Bahraini, you know, other Middle Eastern kingdoms and so on. They're all diverting that food to their markets, and they're controlling agriculture. And then only people really profiting in Africa from all this is the rulers of these countries, you know, and some of the wealthiest donors. And then another crazy thing is in Nigeria, and who was providing food aid critically to Sudan during that famine? was Nigeria, and they were doing it by selling oil to the rest of the world, using that money to buy their own food, and then shipping it to Sudan. And they're, you know, I talked to the Minister of Food Security a couple of times when I was visiting in Abuja, and they said, well, it's not because we're altruistic. We just don't want like 5 million people from Sudan crossing into our country at this point. But we're going to have problems. And now with Boko Haram and all that, you can see that their point might be well taken. You, something that, people that can use to manipulate events to their own favor. So food is a weapon, goes way back. And that, I think, also plays a role in the food not bombs crisis when governments try to stop us. And that's because they know we give out food without restriction to anyone that wants it.
Food is a weapon. Food can be used as a weapon.
Yeah, it's really, there's evidence of Hitler using the withholding of food and the rewarding of food to manipulate events before, you know, leading up to and during World War II. Yeah, the U.S. is done the same thing. AID is
Okay, let's talk about when you do try and feed people who need food. So I understand there are different places in the country that don't allow you, your group, or people in general to feed people who need food.
Yeah, there's roughly right now over 50 cities that have actually banned or limited the distribution of free food in public. And it's not limited to Food Not Bombs, although frequently Food Not Bombs is the target of these actions. And so there's been over 1,000 arrests of Food Not Bombs volunteers starting in August, August 15th, 1988 in San Francisco. But it's more recently we've seen new restrictions in Columbia, South Carolina, where they're demanding we pay $127 a week for a permit. We have to apply for a permit every week to share food there. We've been sharing food there for decades. Other cities, like Orlando, created a law that you could only share food twice a year per park and had to apply for a permit and had to move around to 46 different parks to, you know, so you do, we were sharing and still do share twice a week in Orlando. And so they were making it so that each week you had to get a permit. You could only share in that park for, you know, that week, and then you had to move to another park. And many of the parks actually had no access to anybody, to public transportation or things. So there's no way that anybody would ever be able to get to the parks to eat. You know, they'd have to walk through people's backyards and things.
What do you think the purpose of the permit is in some of these places to have you get a permit? What is that going to do in their minds?
This is what my experience with permits are, is that they have the permits so they can withdraw the permits. and that's what we saw in San Francisco. So at first there was no permit required, but the police arrested us for violating a picnic ordinance or something. It wasn't even clear what the actual rules of that law were, and no one could really explain it. The police just said that they were stopping us because we were making a political statement and that wasn't allowed. But it was park code 7.03, you know, that we were violating. So normally, if you violate that, you'd get a ticket for $25. But in their case, they brought out 45 riot police and arrested 9 of us.
Whoa.
And by the end of the month, they arrested a total of 94 people. And then the mayor gave us a permit. But then, as soon as they wanted to get rid of us again, they deleted the permit process. They, in the meantime, got a court order against us serving food without a permit. And we got arrested for felony conspiracy to serve food in violation of a court order. So that seems to be what the point of the permit process is.
And what are their fears of people giving homeless people or people that are hungry free food?
The issue for most of these is, it turns out, it really does come down to pressure by military contractors in many cases. And there is, and other large corporations who feel that money that would be going to them through government contracts and so on might be diverted to things like education and health care. So, for instance, people think of Orlando's big industry is Disney World. But actually, the larger corporation that brings in as much money as Disney World is Lockheed Martin. Mm. And so there is we don't have evidence that there was a direct conversation between the authorities in Orlando and Lockheed Martin. But it's a big military contracting area in Central Florida because of its connection to Cape Canaveral and all that. And so there, it's just very interesting. Whenever you get a very repressive situation like San Francisco, where we found out it was Bank of America, Bechtel Corporation, and Chevron, and people think of Chevron as an oil company, but we have to remember that half the oil that is used and sold in the United States is sold to the military. So that's a huge, compared to us driving around in cars and stuff, mm-hmm. To have that one customer, the U.S. military, and then to have their tax base be threatened was apparently a threat. Raytheon Missile System, Grumman, General Electric, these are all companies who apparently feel threatened that with the profitability of their contracts in the military. And don't want money, they're feeling that there's only so much tax dollars to go around, and they want to get the largest chunk of it. Right now, they're in all the military, including paying soldiers and stuff, something that, is really essentially minimum wage for, enlisted people, comes to nearly half the federal budget. Some estimate this year was 60% of the federal income tax that people are paying. Is going just to service the military, either past wars or current. Mm,
I don't like hearing that. I don't like to know that. Well, I like to know that, but I don't like to hear it. Yep. Okay. Well, tell me some good stories of where Food Not Bombs came along and fed people and there was a happy ending.
Okay, yeah. There, it turns out there's a ton. Right now, I hope it's not so noisy on this interview, but I'm at the what's called Home Connection, and it's in Santa Cruz, California, and the community has gotten this huge auditorium and put all these homeless services in there, including dental work, eye doctors, podiatrists, wow. All this amazing stuff. And so while I'm outside handing out all this bread and organic produce that I received from local natural food stores here in Santa Cruz, we've been seeing all the people come up and go, oh my God, we love Food Not Bombs, it's just wonderful. And we've got, and this is the thing, we're in 1,000 cities of the world. It's all volunteer. There's no paid staff. We have a website, foodnotbombs.net, that we're going to be upgrading shortly, but it's currently, it's been there. It turns out it was actually, I didn't realize this, but we started this website within the first 12 months of the first commercial websites in America. Mm-hmm. And so it's been up there since 95 and around 95. And you can connect with your local Food Not Bombs chapter there. We have a hunger hotline. That's a toll-free number, 1-800-884-1136. And we get calls, all day long from people seeking food. And then we've done some other projects like relief work. So we're doing providing meals and solar power to charge cell phones and stuff. In the Philippines, even today, which is, we've been doing since the typhoon hit, we provided meals in 20 cities in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Texas after Katrina. And, we were in New Orleans in several locations for over 8 months. We did Sandy relief. We've done earthquake relief, and we also are gearing up to provide meals at protests this weekend against Monsanto.
Yay.
And seeking seed sovereignty and food sovereignty, and really trying to push the whole idea of organics and non-GMO and the idea that food is a right and not a privilege.
Well, you know, I'm glad you mentioned Monsanto just for a moment, because I wanted to bring that up a while back when you were talking about the lack of food distribution in Ethiopia and other places where there's plenty of food, but it's not getting to the people who need it. And companies like Monsanto will use the excuse that they need to improve crops to feed so that these people who are starving will have food to eat. And that's not the problem. The problem is poverty. The problem is lack of democracy. The problem is food distribution and using fertile soil for products that a small group of people benefit from exporting most of the time, rather than feeding the people who are working to grow the stuff. So GMOs is not the way to go. We just need better governments, more democracy, more equality.
Well, GMOs, in fact, because of the intellectual property rights and so on that are associated with the control of these seeds, are actually the leading cause of hunger on Earth right now. And the reason being that you see, like, for instance, in India and many other, countries like that, where they've signed on to World Trade Organization agreements have a relationship with IMF, World Bank, and so on, and they're required to accept genetically modified seeds and chemicals, they find they go bankrupt. So thousands and thousands of farmers in areas where we need more farmers, not less farmers, have gone bankrupt because they can't save their own seeds by contract, and they end up having to get loans to buy the seeds and chemicals, and then less and less land gets cultivated, and less farmers are farming because they've gone bankrupt. There's like thousands of farmers in India, for example, that have committed suicide because of the stress of losing their land to foreclosure because they couldn't afford to pay for the GMO products that they ended up agreeing to grow. And then you see the same thing happening in the United States, not so much the bankruptcy, but problems with cutworms have now, have adapted to BT corn, and so now farmers have to spend even more money on chemicals to kill the cutworms to save their crops, and as a result, the margins are less, and you see like this kind of horrible impact that genetically modified foods are having on food, and then you have things like the dumping of GMO crops in places like Ethiopia, and you have teff, for instance, the one of the oldest grains in the world, grown in Ethiopia, being threatened by Monsanto and Gates Foundation and so on, who are trying to basically gain control of food. And as a result, a lot of people say that the Arab Spring came about because Monsanto had doubled the price of their seeds and chemicals in the year before, and basic food things, grains and particularly corn and flour increased in price so dramatically that the subsidized flour in places like Egypt and Tunisia just became out of reach for many people. They were paying half their total income just on food, and that inspired so much frustration that it evolved into revolutions.
Wow, you never hear that in mainstream news.
Very rarely. You really have to dig for that. I just wrote an article for a chapter in a book on vegan eating and so on, and found a lot of information on that. But you have to dig. It is in some mainstream things, but usually Wall Street Journal in the back pages or something like that.
Keith, we're at the end of the half hour. I wanted to thank you so much for joining me, and you're doing great, great work. Keep going.
Well, thank you so much, and I hope listeners get involved with their local Food Not Bombs group and visit foodnotbombs.net, and because we really need more cooks, and it would be great if we were sharing 7 days a week in all 1,000 cities of the world where we're currently active. So we can, we're an all-volunteer thing, so it's all about people spending their time and coming out and helping collect and cut and share free meals.
Sounds really good. I just wanted to end on a delicious note. I'm looking at your website. I'm looking at your tofu sandwich spread recipe. It looks really yummy.
Yeah, people are always shocked. And I gave that out at Conscious Living Expo down in L.A. a year ago to, hundreds and hundreds of people, and they're like, "What? That's tofu? That's amazing!" You know. And
right. So go to foodnotbombs.net and check out the tofu sandwich spread and everything else that's up there. Keith, thank you again, and just keep doing it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. That's great.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye bye. I'm Karen Hartglass, and this is the end of today's show. It's all about food. Visit ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com, where there are more delicious recipes. I just posted a whole bunch of them. Forbidden nutty rice, chickpea stew, green veggie tofu scramble, toasted buckwheat. A lot of good stuff. So, have a delicious week.